It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Later in the hour, we'll hear the story of how Lance Armstrong fell from legend to conspirator in the world of cycling.
First, we remember this day 50 years ago. It was a Friday like today at 12:30 p.m. our time, when President John F. Kennedy was assassinated while en route to the Dallas Trademark in his motorcade.
President Kennedy and Jackie sat in the back seat of a convertible as crowds of people lined Houston Street. Suddenly, gunfire rang out and Kennedy's motorcade sped away. 2 hours later, Lyndon Johnson was sworn into office on Air Force One.
In the hours and days that followed, the country mourned the loss of America's second youngest president, a man who was known for his hopeful rhetoric. As part of our remembrance of John F. Kennedy, we'd like to hear your stories and memories from that day, November 22nd, 1963. You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. We want to know where you were when you first heard the news. What do you remember from that day and the days that followed? And do you have a story from a parent or a grandparent that you'd like to share? You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@WPR.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. And here to start us off is WPR's regional manager from Superior, John Munson. John, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, and how are you?
Doing okay. Well, you've got a memory that you shared with us this morning over email, and I'd like you to share it again. Do you remember what happened that day when Kennedy was assassinated?
Well, yeah, I was in the fifth grade, and the principal came into our classroom and spoke quietly to Mrs. Asp, my fifth grade teacher, and I remember that she had a real kind of funny expression on her face of surprise, and she announced to the class that the president had died. And I thought she meant President Eisenhower because I couldn't, at 10 years old people are the ones who die. You don't think about somebody who looked as vital and alive as President Kennedy did in those days that, you wouldn't think of him dying. She didn't say the president was shot or assassinated. She said the president has died. I thought she meant President Eisenhower. And because he was an old man and you expected those things to happen.
Do you remember how you felt when you got home, when you talked to your parents?
Well, what happened next was she went and turned on the radio. All of the classrooms had radios, and normally they were set to listen to what was then the State Educational Network, because we got some classes through that. And so we listened to the radio for quite a bit of the rest of the day. And then when I went home, it was the TV was on. There was Walter Cronkite, that whole thing. My mother was a huge, huge supporter of President Kennedy. And actually, it made the 1960 election was pretty interesting in our household because my father was a Nixon Republican. And so they were at odds during the election. She had she once took me to a Kennedy rally in Davenport, Iowa, and held me up so that I could see him. He spoke from the back of a hay wagon. So she was really a big Kennedy supporter. But my father was upset as well. I mean, this kind of thing, I don't care whether you liked Kennedy or not at the time. The president of the United States was assassinated. He was gunned down in broad daylight on the street of a major United States city, and that was shocking to everyone. And I don't think I didn't really understand what was going on, but I took my cue from how my parents reacted, and we were all very sad and just stunned. I mean, it was just unbelievable that happened.
It was a nation in mourning and in shock. Well, John, I want to thank you so much for sharing your memories of that day. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
We've been talking to John Munson, WPR's regional manager in Superior, and we'll get to your calls in just a moment. But first, I want to talk to Dean Kallenbach. This is WPR's regional manager in Eau Claire with his memory. Hi, Dean.
Hi, good to be with you.
Hi. What can you tell us about that day?
Well, I was in kindergarten. I have the memories of a fifth grader, and what I remember, we had half-day kindergarten at the time, so I was actually probably riding the bus home at the time of the shooting, and by the time I came home and came into the house, it was unusual because I grew up on a dairy farm, and it wasn't usual that my dad would still be in for lunch at the time I got home, but he was sitting in front of the television, which was odd, and I remember eating my potato soup. I always link food to all of my key memories. I'm not sure why, but But there was Walter Cronkite talking on the TV, and my mom and my dad were both watching, and I was astute enough, I'm sure, to understand that this was something very big and very different. The two other key memories from the situation I remember is Saturday morning not being able to watch cartoons because it was continuing coverage, and I remember watching the funeral and looking at the little boy who was like my age and thinking, oh, his dad died. That's pretty sad.
Wow.
And then finally, Franklin Elementary School, when we got back to school on Monday, there was a black ribbon on the American flag. And that ribbon stayed up there for a long time. I don't know if it was there for the rest of the school year, but that ribbon on the flag in the classroom was a constant reminder that the president had died.
I'm curious, Dean, is that one of your earliest memories?
Well, it's certainly up there. I mean, I remember a lot of things before that too, but I'm not sure how valid they all are. But this one, you know, there's this that black the visual of this is Walter Cronkite on the black and white TV, and that black ribbon hanging from the flag, which we saw every day when we pledged allegiance.
And one little boy watching another on TV. Dean,
yeah.
Thank you so much for telling your story. Appreciate you joining us.
Happy to do so.
We're talking to Dean Kallenbach, WPR's regional manager in Eau Claire. And we'll take your phone calls now at 1-800-642-1234. Your memories of the day that Kennedy was assassinated. We go first to Joe in Prairie du Chien. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I was 11. I remember we were sitting in the lunchroom, and our school secretary, Mrs. Merriweather, came in, and she said, "Children, the president's been shot. I want you all to go to your homerooms." It's odd. After 50 years, it still strikes me. But we went home, and I was watching TV the next day by myself in the living room, and I saw Ruby shot Oswald on TV. And the next spring, we always went to Texas to see our parents, or our grandparents, excuse me. And we would, my dad specifically got off the interstate, and we drove through Dealey Plaza that year. So it's poignant. It's a transitional thing in my life. I think a lot of people of my age feel the same.
That must have been powerful. And thank you so much for sharing those memories. We appreciate you calling today. And let's go next to Jill in Menominee, Michigan. Hi, Jill.
Hi. I just wanted to share that when I was about 6 years old and I was home from school, and I had a earache, and I remember laying on the couch with the heating pad, and it was dark, so I remember the news coming across, and my mother coming in, and she was my family were big Democratic Union people, so they were obviously a Kennedy supporter, and I remember the shock on her face, and I think at that young of an age, I realized that something big had really happened. And I remember going through the whole, what word would I use? The next week's events of watching, Mr. Kennedy, or President Kennedy, and his son. I remember saluting at the funeral and Jack Ruby and everything. And I just thought I'd share that because, now I'm 57 years old, and that's still very vivid in my mind.
Isn't it interesting how these things happen? And something about that day just crystallized these memories, and it still has stayed with you so sharply. All right, well, Jill, thank you so much for your call. And next to Ken in Milwaukee. Hi, Ken.
Hello. I just had to call and tell you that I was in the classroom in Bethesda, Maryland, the suburb of Washington, right when that happened on that day. And I had seventh grade students, and we were talking away, but all of a sudden in walked my assistant, my cooperating teacher, and she in charge of me, and she said, the president has been shot, to me, quietly.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, my goodness. And it didn't quite come out, and finally the principal came on and mentioned that he noticed that the president had been shot, President Kennedy. And I'm telling you, that class just broke into tears.
Hmm.
It was seventh graders, and a lot of the girls especially, they just wept because they have quite a connection there in Washington area, and some of their parents worked down in the Capitol. And so this is the experience I had. It was a very sad thing, and I tried to comfort them.
What did you say?
Was
there anything that you could say to comfort them?
it might have been something not too, it was something that, this has happened before and it's happened again, something like that. Because we had the social studies class. And so I couldn't calm them down. I tried, but I could not calm them down.
Mm.
And they were just, they broke into tears. That was it, especially the girls. They could, and then the announcement, in walked my regular teacher, and she just said to her that, oh, the class, please calm down. It's just awful, I know. And that's it. And so we let them go. The bell rang, and they left. And I just said, well, I hope all will be well with you today, to them. I was just a student teacher, and I was trying to be nice to them and shocked, taking in the shock myself of living here. It was right in that city where he had been president.
All right. Well, Ken, thank you so much for that memory. Powerful one, and really affecting a lot of young people, as we heard today, who heard about it. And I want to thank you all for sharing with us. Thank you. As we remember John F. Kennedy's assassination 50 years ago today.
Now we'll check the headlines. Then we'll be back with a recount of the fall of cycling legend Lance Armstrong. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later in the program, WPR's news director drops by to round up the top stories of the week, including two big rulings from the state Supreme Court.
First, it was earlier this year when Lance Armstrong admitted to doping throughout his cycling career. The consequences were quick and severe, with Armstrong being stripped of titles, losing sponsors, and being ousted from his own foundation.
Our next guests worked for years covering and breaking stories about the investigation that ended Armstrong's career, and they've written an extensive account of the saga, which they say is the greatest conspiracy in the history of sports.
Reed Albergati and Vanessa O'Connell are reporters at the Wall Street Journal. They're co-authors of the new book, Wheelmen, Lance Armstrong, the Tour de France, and the Greatest Sports Conspiracy Ever. Reed, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
And Vanessa, welcome to you too.
Hey.
So let's start with a couple clips of before and after. First, Lance Armstrong on Larry King Live in 2005.
If you consider my situation, a guy who comes back from arguably a death sentence, why would I then enter into a sport and dope myself up and risk my life again? That's crazy. I would never do that. No way.
And then here's Oprah Winfrey interviewing Lance Armstrong earlier this year.
Yes or no? In all seven of your Tour de France victories, did you ever take banned substances or blood dope?
Yes.
In your opinion, was it humanly possible to win the Tour de France without doping? Seven times in a row.
Not in my opinion.
Well, you both were covering that story for a long time. Vanessa, let's start with you. What was your reaction when he finally made this admission?
Well, we were expecting it, actually. I mean, I had a couple of things going through my mind. We knew at the time from our reporting for the Wall Street Journal on the book Wheelmen that Armstrong was thinking about how he should get out and confess. And he had mulled several options, not only sitting down with Oprah, but also doing sort of a YouTube kind of video or a documentary or writing a book of his own. He eventually went with Oprah. She had interviewed him in the past. They had a friendly acquaintance type relationship, and she had interviewed his ex-wife. I thought that he did a good job at the start of the Oprah interview by acknowledging right off the bat in response to her questions that he had doped, but he sort of blew it from there. And as you know, I'm sure that the interview went on for 2 hours, was broken into two parts. And a lot of members of the public really thought he came across as unremorseful. So in many ways, his goal was to regain some popularity, and he did not achieve that at all with the Oprah interview.
Reed, backing away from that moment, that admission, you've written that this story isn't just a sports story or a story about a doping or an individual. You view it in part, a big part, as a business story. Why?
Well, I mean, it really, if this were a story just about one athlete cheating in a sport, it wouldn't have been something that drew our interest and that kept us so fascinated with it for so many years. So when we set out to write the book, we really wanted to give the reader a broad sense of both the history of this, how American cycling developed to allow this conspiracy to really unfold, and B, explain all the people around Armstrong who were enablers of this conspiracy, who helped keep the secret over the years. And that actually is a lot more interesting when you look at it in the framework of really this was a business enterprise all designed to keep a secret than, you know, just an athlete cheating.
Before we get into the conspiracy to keep this secret, Vanessa, once upon a time, cycling was not a big deal in the United States. How did it rise to become a sport where there was so much at stake?
Well, that is a really interesting part of the story and one that we really bring out in the book. In the earliest chapters, for instance, we really look at how the United States was laughable in the sport of professional cycling. And we really didn't have any pros in this country. And Greg LeMond, of course, was one of the first Americans to win the Tour de France, and he broke a lot of barriers there. But then, shortly after his success and around the time of Armstrong's rise, there was this concerted effort by a small group of American businessmen to build a team that would focus on winning the Tour de France. And that was different from the way a lot of European teams focused on the sport. They would enter in races throughout the season, all over Europe. The Americans, in contrast, really focused their time, energy, and resources on winning the Tour de France and looking for the biggest bang for their buck. So it really very much was a business enterprise with a specific goal, winning that race.
Why did they have this goal? Why did these wealthy people who got into funding this want to do this, Reed?
Oh, I mean, there were many reasons. One is money. I mean, there were people who were benefiting from this financially. But the other is they got to be close to Lance Armstrong, who, as you probably remember, may or may not remember, is that he was considered the next governor of Texas at one point, of a potential presidential candidate. He was hobnobbing with people like George W. Bush. The guy was larger than life, and it was a lot of cachet to be around him.
And let's talk about what a big deal Lance Armstrong was. I mean, nobody dominated a sport. Tiger Woods maybe came close, Wayne Gretzky, now Jimmy Johnson in NASCAR. But, I mean, this was really a unique domination of a sport, wasn't it, Vanessa?
Absolutely. So, you know, Americans really got behind Armstrong from his first win of the Tour de France in 99. And then, of course, he went on to win 7 consecutive times. And he became such a phenomenon that he really, his popularity transcended well beyond cycling. And he, you know, built his foundation. He had backing from Trek, Oakley, Nike, Bristol-Myers Squibb, and the list goes on and on. So he really became, you know, to many Americans, the equivalent of professional cycling. And again, it's a sport that Europeans had dominated for years. So to have an American win the Tour de France 7 times was something we as a country, you know, were really proud of.
Well, and of course, we found out afterwards that doping was a big part of that. Now, I will admit, when I think of sports doping, I think maybe there's this one guy and he has kind of a shady doctor and there's, you know, injections. It was way bigger than that. Can you talk, Reed, about the scope of the doping operation?
Yeah, I mean, in cycling, yeah, that is the big difference. Cycling is, contrary to what people might think here in the U.S., it's a team sport, and those athletes have to work together. Armstrong could not have won the Tour de France, even taking all the drugs, without a very, very strong team around him. And the team needed to be strong for Armstrong. So the doping program was all designed to get them up to speed and maximized for the Tour de France. So it involved blood transfusions at a certain point where athletes on the team would actually take bags of blood. They'd remove blood from their body, keep it in a refrigerator, and then reinfuse the blood during the Tour de France. And that happened. I mean, there's one scene in the book where that happened on the team bus. They pretended to break down on the side of the road, set up cones and everything, and did a blood transfusion with the whole team on the bus, and that was to avoid the prying eyes of French law enforcement or journalists.
Was there a sense, Vanessa, that they couldn't win without drugs? Everybody else was doing it, an undoped team didn't have a chance?
Yes, and you know, I think, Rob, what's interesting to us is that they really viewed it as a level playing field. They felt like everyone else was doping, and they had to dope as well. So there was no real, you know, remorse on their part about this secret that they had, that they had doped to win, and the secret that they shared. It's pretty amazing when you think about the number of people that were actually in on it, that there was this secret that remained for so long, a secret. in fact, Armstrong really almost got away with it. It was just a couple of fluke incidents that eventually led to his acknowledging on Oprah that he had doped.
We're talking with Reed Albergati and Vanessa O'Connell. O'Connell. They're authors of Wheelmen, a book about mainly Lance Armstrong. Coming up, we'll get into the role of the media and anti-doping agencies in the United States and around the world. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett. We pick up our conversation now with Vanessa O'Connell and Reed Albergati about the Lance Armstrong saga, which they say is the greatest conspiracy in the history of sports. Reed and Vanessa are authors of the book Wheelmen. Vanessa, Lance and his teammates and the people around them, they're using these drugs, a variety of them. But isn't there a big anti-doping effort in the United States, around the world, at the Tour de France itself? Why didn't they pick up on this sooner?
Well, that's a really good question. The anti-doping effort, actually, in the United States is not that old. I mean, it really kind of gained steam only recently in the last, 7 or 8 years. There was testing during the Tour de France, but it was by different entities and not the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. Those tests were incredibly easy for the riders to beat. And in fact, around the time that the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency was formed and started to test Armstrong aggressively, he had missed a test, and he had a conversation with the head of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency about that missed test. The head of the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency said to Armstrong, you know, if you're really clean and you're a clean rider, you should be happy that we're doing this testing. You should be happy we're on the scene now because, you know, when you pass our tests, that is proof that you're a clean rider, a clean athlete. So Armstrong sort of used that argument in his defense when he was faced with allegations that he had doped. He would often, you know, respond that he had passed all of these drug tests, and how could that be if he was doping? So he sort of used the anti-doping agency's mission and testing strategy against it to sway public opinion.
And Reed, a big character in this story is Travers Tygart with that U.S. anti-doping agency. Can you talk about how he pursued this doping case?
Yeah, actually, I think that the writing this part of the story was a really fun part of the book because a lot of people Travers Tygart really came into the public consciousness in the last year when he went after Armstrong and ultimately stripped him of his titles. But really, the relationship starts, you know, back in the 2004 time period. Armstrong actually asked Tygart to sign an affidavit saying that he had passed all the tests in a litigation with an insurance company that was refusing to pay Armstrong's bonuses. They claimed that he doped. Turned out to be right. But Tygart really was slow to eventually realize that, yeah, I mean, this was a huge doping conspiracy, and it was something they should go after. Before, you know, there was a federal criminal investigation, and before Floyd Landis, Armstrong's former teammate, came forward, this really wasn't on the radar screen of USADA.
And was it hard to pursue Lance Armstrong in part because of his widespread popularity, in part because of the story, you know, cancer survivor becomes world champion, and in part because of his philanthropy?
I would say, yeah.
It was very hard.
Go ahead.
It was very hard for the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency to pursue him. You know, in part, they were going after a cancer survivor who was a hero to many. And even Reed and I saw that in covering the story for the Wall Street Journal, we would get a lot of hate letters. We'd get a lot of hate mail saying, why are you going after this American icon? You know, and your sources are bad. You know, one of the issues that faced Travis Tygart was that Floyd Landis, Armstrong's former teammate, who really, you know, was a tipping point for his downfall when Floyd Landis stepped forward and put in emails details about the doping that had taken place on the team, was very difficult for the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, known as USADA, and for Travis Tygart, who's head of that agency, because Floyd had lied in the past. He was a liar. So that was a big factor as well. In the end, though, there had been this criminal investigation, and about at least 10 of Armstrong's teammates had testified to prosecutors or met with them and provided them with evidence. And it was a little easier for Travis Tygart to step into this investigation in the wake of the criminal investigation, because the riders were used to talking about the doping that had taken place, at least to prosecutors, not in public, but to prosecutors, that it was a little bit easier for Travis to get them to speak to him.
And Reed, we just heard how you guys got hate mail for pursuing this investigation. Do you think the media at large, the sports media in particular, did too much to cover up for Lance Armstrong, or too much to argue his case?
Oh, absolutely. And it is something that we get into in the book. I mean, you had major newspapers, major news organizations covering the Tour de France 24/7. And all these allegations would come out of the woodwork. Every year, there'd be some new allegation about Armstrong, some of it really damning. I mean, a French television crew followed the team doctors 50 miles away from the race when they were dumping this exotic calf's blood drug that wasn't quite banned but wasn't quite allowed either. You know, eventually, a huge story came out, and you played the clip from the Larry King show where Armstrong was denying everything. And, you know, that was in response to six of his samples from the 1999 Tour de France being retested and testing positive for EPO. You didn't really hear about those stories in detail in the American press. And I would say, I mean, you know, the Wall Street Journal did not have a sports page at the time. So, you know, it took us a while to get into it. But I think around the 2008 time period, we started to write more about sports. And that's really how, you know, Vanessa and I got into the story.
So a point you make, especially at the end of your book, is that there is a lot of blame to go around here, not just Lance Armstrong. But how culpable is he? How much blame does he deserve after covering this story?
Well, Rob, that's a really good question, and that's also partly why we call the book Wheel Men, rather than Wheel Man, is because we view this conspiracy as definitely broader than Armstrong. There are a lot of people who supported him, who were in on it, and who, you know, had willful blindness to his doping, who were right there but didn't really ask him the tough question of whether these allegations were true. But he is very culpable, and he was taking advice from his lawyers, you know, so he did turn to them for advice, and they steered him wrong in some instances that we wrote about in the book. He got bad legal advice. But at the end of the day, you know, it was all about his desire to win, and it's sort of a quirk of his personality, and maybe a flaw of his personality, is that he feels he has to win. He has to get those extra 10 feet. And that was really what drove him to lie the way he did and to go after his accusers so viciously. And, you know, he really did make the mess that he is now dealing with.
I want to get into some where are they now. First of all, Reed, U.S. cycling as a sport, is it in ruins? Is it something that is still on the table? Where is it?
Well, they don't have a star figure like Armstrong, and they're also dealing with, you know, huge image problems now. I mean, this all really went on right under their noses, and a lot of people have questions about, you know, what did people at the top levels of the sport in the U.S. know, and when did they know it? I think there are some positive developments in the sport of cycling. We have new leadership in the international governing body of the sport, the UCI, the people who were minding the ship while all of this was going on, while the culture of doping was really flourishing in cycling. You know, those people have been pushed out of the sport, or at least the people at the top levels. And I think now, you know, there's talk of a so-called Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which would air all of this dirty laundry and, you know, hopefully clean up the ranks even more, get rid of the, you know, the people who were really responsible for these problems on the coaching ranks and you know, former riders who were right in the middle of this and are now in leadership positions of the sport.
And Vanessa, Lance Armstrong himself, is there a comeback possible for him?
You know, it's going to be really interesting. Reed and I were talking about this earlier. You know, Tiger Woods, for instance, is comparable in many ways because his image was so tarnished. But Tiger was able to, you know, get back on the golf course and compete. Armstrong cannot, you know, get back on the bike or get in a triathlon or a swimming competition because he's been banned from elite-level sport for life. So it's going to be very hard for him to regain any kind of popularity with the public. If he could get back out and compete, I think it'd be a lot easier for him. He's going to have to come up with a plan to make people want to like him again based on his personality alone, which is a new challenge for him to face. But he is only 42, and he's incredibly resilient, so I think he will, you know, figure out a plan going forward. But it will be interesting to watch him try to, you know, again sort of regain any sort of credibility with the public.
And Reed, if we watch the Tour de France or other major cycling events, can we still assume that a lot of these guys are doping?
I think there's definitely doping going on in cycling and in every professional sport. There's just too much money, too much pride involved. People want to cut corners, but I think that the drug testing has gotten better. It's not foolproof, and it never will be. But there's also new testing that looks at riders' blood values over a long period of time. And what that does is it really reduces the amount of drugs and the specific types of drugs that riders can take. And that lowers the benefit that you get from performance-enhancing drugs. And the other positive is that you have organizations like the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency and Travis Tiger working with law enforcement to try and gather intelligence and catch the cheaters that way. So I think the atmosphere points toward a cleaner sport, but it'll never be entirely clean.
We'll leave it there. Reed, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
Vanessa, thanks to you as well.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Vanessa O'Connell and Reed Albergati. They're authors of Wheelmen, Lance Armstrong, the Tour de France, and the greatest sports conspiracy ever.
Coming up next, WPR's news director stops by to recap the top news stories of the week, including rulings on controversial issues by the Supreme Court.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up on Central Time, a look at loneliness. When do we cross the line from spending time alone to feeling lonely? Our guest will have some advice.
First, WPR news director Michael Leland joins us for our weekly look at the top stories affecting us here in Wisconsin.
Michael, thanks for joining us again.
Happy to be here.
Well, the legislature wrapped up its session, but there's no news drought because the Supreme Court picked up the slack, it looked like. What's one of the big stories coming out of there?
Exactly. A couple of big stories from the Supreme Court this week. First, that the Supreme Court said this week that it would hear two arguments in lawsuits that involve Wisconsin's voter ID law. Of course, the legislature passed that law in 2011, and then it was blocked by a judge in early 2012.
So who is filing these particular lawsuits?
Well, one of the lawsuits in this case is from the NAACP and the immigrant rights group Voces de la Frontera, and it was the first suit that resulted in the law being blocked. That's when a Dane County judge ruled that it placed an undue burden on the right to vote. The suit was scheduled for a hearing before an appeals court in Waukesha next month, but now that hearing's been canceled because the Supreme Court says that it will hear the case.
That's interesting. They jumped ahead, kind of. It could have gone to appeals, then the Supreme Court. They said, nope, we're in now.
Well, it's sort of tied to the other suit from the League of Women's Voters, which said that the legislature didn't have the power under the state constitution to require a photo ID to vote. It won in Dane County Circuit Court, was struck down by an appeals court. So then both of these suits are headed to the Supreme Court. Basically, the Supreme Court said, since we're going to hear this other one, and they both deal with the Voter ID Act, and we need all of these to pass before a decision's going to be made, why don't we just take them both up? Because it's going to end up here anyway.
Gotcha. So if the appeals court did something on the one, it didn't matter because the Supreme Court was going to rule on the other.
Exactly. So now the Supreme Court will deal with both of these sometime next year, and a decision would come out by June.
All right. Are there any major elections coming up next year that would be influenced by this?
There are a few elections that may be influenced by this. We've got, of course, the big primary in August, then the general election in November. So, a lot of people eagerly awaiting to hear what the court says about the voter ID law in Wisconsin.
Now, as I recall, there was a passel of lawsuits over the last couple of years. Are these the only ones still in the game?
No, there are two that are still pending against the voter ID law. The two other ones were just the subject of a trial in federal court in Milwaukee just a couple of weeks ago, and a decision on those suits is expected early in the new year. And my understanding is that all four of them have to basically be cleared for the voter ID law to go ahead.
And so the legislature, we talked briefly, ultimately didn't complicate the issue by passing a whole new, slightly different voter ID law, right?
Right. That has been passed by one of the, mm-hmm. the houses, not the other. And of course, the governor hasn't signed it. But, you know, if you remember, the Senate had been saying that it didn't see any reason to move ahead with this legislation because these other cases were still in court and it would make more sense to see how the courts ruled on that. The Assembly went ahead and passed it. And so we'll see what happens with that next year. But then, of course, we're also waiting to hear what the courts decide.
All right. Yeah. Seems like it was plenty complicated enough already without that legislative action. Okay. And the other big thing out of the Supreme Court this week.
Right. This just happened yesterday. The state Supreme Court ruled 5-2 that a Dane County judge went too far last month when he put union recertification elections on hold for county and municipal workers. This, of course, involves Act 10, the law that passed almost 2.5 years ago now, amid weeks of protests both inside and outside the state capitol. Part of that law requires public employee unions to hold recertification elections each year.
So, but one judge, as I recall, put a wrinkle into that.
Exactly. In the fall of 2012, Dane County Circuit Judge Juan Colas found part of the law unconstitutional. He said it violated union workers' rights of association and equal protection. That was in a lawsuit filed by Madison's Teachers Union and city workers in Milwaukee. The Supreme Court heard that case just a couple of weeks ago and will have a decision by summer.
So, but there's actually action here on the contempt order. Now, it's getting a little complicated for
me. Yes, it is.
Walk me through that contempt order and what happened there.
Okay, so the contempt order was from Judge Colas against the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission. And that's the organization that's in charge of these recertification elections. He had held the group in contempt for holding elections for unions that were not part of this other lawsuit. He said that because his earlier ruling was still in the courts, that the WERC shouldn't have gone ahead with those elections. The Supreme Court, on the other hand, ruled that Judge Colas went too far. It said that he should not have issued the contempt order because he had never issued any injunction against those elections being held. And in effect, the contempt ruling expanded the scope of the judgment that is before the Supreme Court right now.
Okay. So the judge says, I'm looking at these two cases. I say no recertification elections mm-hmm. and... he didn't do an official injunction, but he says that should apply to any, even the ones not directly involved in this case. They hold them, contempt. Supreme Court says, nope, no contempt. You didn't. It's out of your jurisdiction a little bit.
In fact, there was a request that the Supreme Court also strike down the judge's ruling that the Act 10 itself, you know, parts of it were unconstitutional. They declined to do that, but they did, take away this contempt ruling. The WERC is going to meet next week and talk about holding those recertification elections that it had planned to hold in the first place.
These things just keep rippling on and on into the
do.
Future. 2.5 years ago on mm-hmm. Act 10, we were talking earlier today. It seems like just a few months ago.
It does.
The Capitol was swarmed with protesters. All right. Well, speaking of the Capitol, lawmakers aren't in session, but their committees are going. Mm-hmm. We talked to Kevin Riley, outgoing UW system president, last week. One of the big issues was the UW reserve plan that got controversial. What's the latest on that?
Okay. So this came before the legislature's audit committee, and it put off voting on how much the UW system would be able to keep in its reserves. It says it needs more information from the system first. Now, earlier this year, you remember that the UW Board of Regents created a policy that said its campuses should have reserves of at least 10% of the prior year's expenditures and then would have to justify reserves higher than 15%.
And that came out of a controversy that erupted in the legislature.
Right, much bigger controversy earlier in the year that actually affected how much money the UW system got from the legislature, from the state. Legislative Audit Bureau earlier this year found the UW system had about $750 million on hand at the end of June of last year. The state then froze UW's tuition, cut the system's funding in this current budget, and then went ahead and told the regents to come up with a policy on how much money campuses could keep on hand. If essentially, the legislature felt that at a time when tuition kept going up, the UW shouldn't have had this much money on hand.
So the audit committee has this on hold kind of now. What are they looking for?
They say they need more information about how the UW system is going to measure its reserves to get to that 10% target. And then once the committee approves the plan, of course, it also needs to be approved by the legislature's Joint Finance Committee.
So maybe when this is all done, the university system, the regents, the legislature will all be on the same page, and nobody's going to be surprised or outraged by the numbers they see.
Exactly. I think everybody agrees that it makes sense to have reserves. It's just a matter of how much. I think they've agreed on this 10 to 15% range, and now the state just wants to know how the UW is going to measure that.
Okay. Anything else coming up with the legislature in the near term?
Yeah. Just earlier today, the governor announced that December 2nd will be the day that he calls the legislature back into a special session. You remember last week he said he was going to do this because he wanted lawmakers to basically lengthen the amount of time that people have to apply for federal health insurance coverage under the Affordable Care Act. There are about 80,000, I think, people who are going to be essentially kicked off Badger Care, the state's Medicaid program, and required to buy insurance on this exchange. Well, because of all the problems we've had getting people signed up on the exchange, there was a fear that people wouldn't make that deadline to get their new insurance by January 1st. That's going to be stretched into the end of March, and lawmakers will start talking about that on December 2nd.
And I've heard some back and forth. We should extend it until March, or we should try to do it on a month-by-month provisional basis. That's got to be hashed out in the legislature?
I think that's going to be a subject of discussion. The governor would like it to be March 31st. There have been, as you said, some who said, let's make it month-to-month. Others who say, well, let's make it March 31st, but let's make that a solid deadline with no more extensions and just hope that the federal government has its system up and running better by then.
This is going to be something we get to talk about in December.
Absolutely.
Michael, thanks a lot for joining us.
Have a good weekend.
You too.
That was WPR News Director Michael Leland. Well, some big news coming up. Tomorrow is the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who. The BBC science fiction show became a big hit on public television here in the United States. And a special 50th anniversary episode comes out tomorrow. Here's a clip from that trailer.
I've had many faces, many lives.
Exterminate!
And there's one life I've tried very hard to forget.
I'm looking for the Doctor.
Well, you've certainly come to the right place.
The lead character is the Doctor, a time and space traveling alien who looks like a human. He regenerates into new bodies over the years, allowing him to be played by a number of different actors. My favorite, and probably the favorite of everyone I grew up who grew up at the same time, is Tom Baker, the fourth Doctor. It's a pretty common favorite, I think, but he was funny. He had a giant long scarf.
He had great hair.
Great hair. And now I know, Veronica, you've appreciated some of the newer Doctors since they restarted the series.
I would have said Tom Baker back in the day because everyone likes Tom Baker. Mm-hmm. But now that the new iteration of Doctor Who is out, I think I have to, I mean, it's hard to pick. I loved Eccleston. David Tennant was awesome. He looked great in a bow tie. And they've really done a great job casting, I think, these new generation of Doctor Whos.
My kids have started watching some of the new ones. I don't know if it'd be worth it to go back to the old ones. I don't know how they'll hold up. The famous cardboard sets. It was not a high budget enterprise in a lot of ways.
Canine.
Yeah, but I was really into it. I had novels, I had the novelizations, and this is back in the days of antennas. I could get four different sources of Doctor Who: Detroit Public Television, Toledo, Ohio, and the two different stations on the CBC out of Ontario. And I could, if I tuned it just right, I could pick up any of them. So I could watch Doctor Who for hours on end if my parents were
for
out.
For us, it was a Sunday night ritual. And yeah, I really liked K-9. That was the little electronic dog. And I think there was just the special effects, though. They were so campy back then. Now when you look at it, it's laughable. But look at how it's gone on. It's had legs and people love it, and it's inspired fans and even a guy from public radio who built his own TARDIS.
That's right, Brian. Well, how about you? Are you a fan? Do you have a favorite Doctor Who episode, lead actor or companion character? Share them on the Central Time Facebook page.
Well, we'll get to the news with a classic version of the Doctor Who theme song, and this is Central Time on the Ideas Network.